Welcome to Australian Aviation Radio. I'm your host, Robert Bruss. Australian Aviation Radio is proudly brought to you by Afterburner, accelerating the performance of your organization by teaching flawless execution. Afterburner seminars are dedicated to sharpening awareness, enabling decision-making, taking action, and driving accountability using proven methods developed by military fast jet pilots. To find out more, take action and visit afterburner.com.au. Australian Aviation Radio is the official podcast of the Australian Aviation Magazine. If you haven't already subscribed, pop open your favourite podcasting app and hit that subscribe button, and don't forget to leave us a review. You can visit our website at australianaviation.com.au and make sure you follow along in social media on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and of course on our YouTube channel. Welcome to the Australian Aviation Podcast. I'm here at the New South Wales Ambulance and Toll Rescue Helicopter Base over at Bankstown Airport. And I'm here today with Tim Frankel, who's one of the senior contract pilots for Toll. How are you doing, Tim? It's great to have you on the show, mate.
Thanks. Good to be here.
Excellent. Well, I wanted to first of all talk about the 40th anniversary of Black Hawk coming into service and that all happening. It's been a very, very long time that that aircraft's been in service across many different militaries across the world. And I was watching some YouTube videos before saying that the Americans want to keep it in service to 2070. Can you believe it? I'm not sure if the airframes are going to last that long, but that's a pretty interesting statistic straight from Lockheed Martin and Sikorsky there. I don't know how true it is. But before we get into any of that, let's just kick off the show and get a little bit of background on you. Where are you from? How'd you get into aviation? And what are you doing now?
So I'm English by birth. Been an Australian now for about 15 years. I'm ex-British Army, did 10 years in the British Army flying Lynx, Squirrel, and for some of that time, Black Hawks with the Australian Army. After about 10 years in the British Army, I transferred to the Australian Army and I continued my career flying Black Hawks in Townsville. I instructed on Black Hawks in Oakey, and then I moved down to Holsworthy and I did my last 3 years in the Australian Army in Holsworthy, flying Black Hawks initially and then finishing off on Kiowa.
Oh, fantastic. And was aviation always something that was in your blood when you were a little kid?
Yes, it was. I remember I grew up in Africa and I grew up in Ethiopia and I was there during the time of the famine. And I remember the Royal Air Force came out to do relief operations in their C-130s, and this is a long time ago. This is in the mid-80s, and they took me for a fly.
Oh, no way.
They actually let me fly the aircraft about an eight-year-old.
Oh, gosh.
And there's no one in the RAF will get sacked for it now, I think. It's that long ago. And from then on, I had the bug. So flying around Ethiopia doing, I wasn't actually obviously doing the air drops, but on the flight. And from that moment on, I knew I wanted to be a pilot.
Wow, fantastic. And what about your parents? Did they encourage you into it?
Very much so. I was very fortunate. When I was 15, I learned to glide, and they paid for all of that. So I got my glider pilot's license before I could drive, and that's thanks to my parents.
Oh, fantastic. And was the military always an option for you, or was it something that kind of just happened?
No, I'd known for a while that I wanted to fly in the military, and that sort of cemented with me when I was at university, and I sort of made my mind up when I was at uni, and then joined the army. As soon as I finished university, I joined the army.
Okay, so you're in the uni. You weren't at university in the military at all?
No, I wasn't.
Okay, so you got your degree in?
In the UK.
Yeah, in aeronautical engineering.
That's right, yeah. I got a degree in aeronautical engineering, which I've really not really ended up using at all.
Hasn't helped you as a pilot?
It has helped me with the principles of flight lessons and the tech. Yeah. I've always managed to do that without doing too much work, thanks to 3 years slaving away at university. That's all I can say for it, really.
Yeah, right. Oh, that's so interesting that it doesn't play. I was talking to an F-18 pilot a couple of weeks back, and he had a university degree in mathematics.
Yeah.
And I asked him, did it help you as a fighter pilot at all? And he was like, well, I'm not sure. I don't really know what it was like without it, so I can't really say.
I can say categorically no, and that's because, you know, the way that the military runs its flying training is it doesn't require you to have an engineering degree. And I have a very close friend of mine, indeed, he's a pilot on this contract, an ex-Black Hawk pilot, has a degree in music.
Oh, right.
No problems at all.
Gosh, fantastic, fantastic. Well, flying a helicopter is like, what's it like? Something like playing an instrument, playing the drums, balancing a broomstick on your fingertip. There's so many different descriptions that I hear of it all the time. I'm sure a degree in music might help a little bit, does it?
Probably, but I wouldn't know because I'm not that musical.
Excellent. Tell me about your early aviation career in the British Army. Did you learn to fly a fixed-wing plane?
I did. So I did my flight screening before I joined the Army, very similar to the way things run in Australia. Before you'll allowed to join the military and undergo flying training, you have to get screened. So I underwent flying screening in the UK in 1993, I think, on chipmunks.
Right.
And these are chipmunks which had a shotgun start. So they had a cartridge with six shotgun rounds in it. And yeah, it was incredible. That's probably the one thing I remember more than anything. Yeah, so I did about 13 hours flying chipmunk, which was incredible. Hard work, because they certainly don't make it easy for you. And then I went on to finish uni. I went to Sandhurst to do my officer training, and then underwent flying training initially on the UK's basic flight, the British military's basic training aircraft, which is the Firefly. So it's an all-composite training aircraft. And from then, I went to fly squirrels for about 12 months, and a combination of sort of basic rotary, advanced rotary, tactics package. And when I finished flying squirrels, I transitioned onto the Lynx Mark 7, which is the skidded anti-tank variant of the Lynx. Learned to fly that, and then I was posted to a different variant of Lynx squadron. So it was the wheeled variant of Lynx, not the Navy variant, but it was called the light battlefield helicopter. So really a utility variant of the Lynx, and I spent 2 or 3 years flying around Europe and ops in the Lynx.
Fantastic. That's a sexy machine.
It is, yeah, and I'm very
fast.
So it holds the record, but actually, Black Hawk, in terms of its standard operating speeds, the Black Hawk's much faster.
Right.
Black Hawk's much faster. It is a very, very sexy machine. I'm very disappointed, actually. It's kind of been reinvented in the UK, and it's gone back into service as the Wildcat.
Right.
And I'm disappointed because I thought they should have kept the name Lynx, because it's really still a Lynx. It's been re-engined, obviously, new cockpit, new transmission, new airframe, but it looks like a Lynx.
Right, right. Isn't a Lynx one that can do like a barrel roll or a loop?
It can do a barrel roll, it can do a loop, but its speciality maneuver is the backflip.
Right.
So from a hover, it will literally rotate around the tail rotor and do a sort of loop in place, if you like.
Do you learn to do that, or is that just the demo pilot to do that in a test pilot?
No, definitely not.
You didn't,
not even the instructors are allowed to do that. So the Army Air Corps has an aerobatics team called the Blue Eagles, and they're the only people who fly the Lynx that way.
Specialized training. What is it about the Lynx that makes it aerobatic capable like that?
So it's got a very, very rigid rotor head. Most traditional helicopters have got rotors that are free to move in three axes. And although the Lynx rotor head does allow the blade to move in three axes, it's very, very rigid. It's actually connected to the rotor head is a single titanium forging. And so rather than using a joint, if you like, or a bearing to flap and lead lag, it actually uses the flex of the titanium spar. The only actual bearing in the Lynx main rotor head is the feathering bearing, which allows you to change the pitch of the blades. Otherwise, it's all done with the flex of the spars.
And that's what gives it the ability to take the G-loading on the blades?
Oh, pretty much. I'm sure some guy who's got more time on Lynx will ring up and say, I've got it wrong. Because it's been a long time since I've flown Lynx. I stopped flying Lynx in the last time I flew a Lynx. Was 2001.
Yeah, long time ago. So you go through your basic flight training, learn to fly fixed-wing plane, you learn to fly the squirrel, then you move on to more advanced aircraft. It's still an old-school machine, right? It doesn't have a glass cockpit or anything like that, does it?
The Lynx, it does now. The Wildcat does, but no. It didn't. It was full steam-driven cockpit. But even even the squirrel that I learned to fly was fully steam-driven, if you like, fully analog. And it wasn't till really the very end of my career, ironically, flying Kiowas with the Australian Army that I actually flew with a bit of glass in the cockpit. The Australian Army upgraded its fleet of Kiowas with a sort of semi-glass, couple of Garmin 430s, glass HSI, glass AI, and that was the first time I'd seen any glass or flown with glass. You know, the Black Hawk, again, a steam-driven cockpit, very analog.
And in the British Army, you were lucky enough to go on operations to the Balkans and in Pakistan as well, right?
Yes and no. I flew on operations in Kosovo, I was very fortunate to be the squadron that was there during NATO's move into Kosovo from Macedonia during the Kosovo War in 1999. A very interesting time of my life, I don't mind saying. And then after that, I went on my exchange with the Australian Army, and then I went on ops to East Timor in 2002.
Right, excellent.
Pakistan wasn't until later when I was in the Australian Army.
Right, okay. And tell me about flying on operations. Did all the training that you do in anticipation back in the UK, did that prepare you, or were you kind of...
Absolutely. I mean, the type of operations that it was peacekeeping or peace enforcement, I guess, in Kosovo. So you know, we weren't flying around at 15 feet, going under wires, shooting missiles at anyone. But, you know, the training itself was very valuable, yes.
Mm-hmm. Did you take fire any time?
Not that I knew of.
Not that you knew.
Well, you can't hear it. You can't hear it. So unless you can see the tracer.
You don't know.
You don't know.
Yeah.
It's best that way.
How about at nighttime? You're flying around at nighttime there?
A lot of night vision goggle stuff in Kosovo, yeah.
Yeah, and the mountains and stuff?
Very mountainous area. We're there sort of transition from winter all the way through the summer, and it goes from being freezing cold. The Balkans are freezing cold in winter, snowbound to a large extent, certainly in the mountains, and then go right the way through to being boiling hot in summer. Big mountains, you know, up to 3,000 meters.
Wow.
So as a helicopter pilot, you know, you go from having to, there's a number of different sort of skill sets that you really need to pull together to fly in all those varied conditions.
Yeah, and it's different every day, right?
Pretty much. You know, we were flying low level, high level, night, day, NVG. We're flying into Albania a lot. We're flying into Greece a lot. I actually flew into Athens.
Wow.
And I remember flying over the Acropolis going, I really shouldn't be allowed to do this. So it was very interesting, very varied.
Yeah, very exciting time to do that. What was the biggest takeaway for you from there? Can you remember? Is there one big takeaway? One big lesson learned?
Yeah, it's the closest I've ever come to dying in a helicopter, actually.
And oh, really?
I remember towards the back end of our time there, we were there for 6 months. I remember we were very relaxed by this stage. You know, a lot of the sort of riskier stuff had all been and gone, and we were definitely very comfortable in the operating area. And we were flying down as a formation of two links down a valley, and we're flying about 500 feet down the middle of the valley. We weren't flying wire aware, and I remember I was distracted by the aircraft flying behind us. They're actually taking some imagery of us, and I was a bit focused on that. I was a co-pilot. And I remember just looking up and seeing about six strands of wires right in front of me at about 100 meters, literally. I just looked at it and I went, we're dead. And I was really lucky that the aircraft captain, who's one of the senior instructor in the squadron, senior instructor in the Army aircraft actually, he just went down and I was flying the aircraft, and he just pushed the cyclic as forward, as far, hard as he could, and we bunted underneath the wires. And we pretty much both went into shock. We were totally silent, I think ashen-faced. Couldn't believe that we'd just, you know, nearly flown into sort of six strands of wire. We would almost certainly have died.
You're flying straight and level?
We were flying straight and level, but we weren't flying. I mean, when you're flying wire away, you're supposed to fly down the side of a valley.
So you can see them.
So you can see the staunchions.
Yeah.
And so you're not flying over the part of the valley where the wires are suspended, and you're also supposed to fly two-thirds of the way up, because, you know, it's unlikely that you're going to have wire suspended in that position.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, unbeknownst to us, while we're sort of recovering from it, we went under another set of wires, which we didn't even see.
Oh my gosh, what about your oppo behind?
So he didn't see those either. I remember him just, we just debriefed on the ground, obviously, and he said he couldn't believe it, but he didn't see that other set either. And it's not till I flew down that same valley a week or two later and I saw this other strand of wires at a similar height, maybe 500 meters further on, we didn't even know about it. Straight under it. So that certainly taught me about flying much more wire aware.
What did you learn about being a co-pilot and the captain there who got a hold of the cyclic there? He registered, he pushed it down.
Oh, yeah, so there was no sort of I have control taking over. He did what he had to do to save the aircraft. You know, I guess what did I learn about being a co-pilot? You learn how to be a good follower. You know, there's a lot of high pressure flying in marginal weather where you had to achieve tasks, and you learn about trust, you learn about good communication, and you learn how to follow.
Did it make you a better team?
Yeah, of course it did. And you know, the crews rotated constantly, and so I was quite new to the squadron. I was there with a friend, a colleague of mine, who was also quite new to the squadron, and when we joined the squadron, it was already a very tight-knit group of people. But by the end of the 6 months, we were part of that group.
And is that something that can happen to any helicopter pilot? I mean, I don't fly rotary, I fly fixed wing, so that's not really ever really a danger for me, because I'm not down in the weeds like that doing what you guys do. But you know, is taking your eye off the ball for just a second or two like that, anybody can do that, right?
Anyone can do it, which is why you've always got to afford yourself a sensible margin of safety. You know, a lot of the time, the sort of profiles that you're flying in a military aircraft, those margins are reduced. You know, so it's standard low flying in a civil aircraft, 500 feet, whereas in a military aircraft, you could be going down to 50, 20,
gosh,
10 feet,
yeah,
and your margin of error is reduced.
Mm-hmm.
And so when your margin of error reduces, then you have to be that much more focused.
Yeah, absolutely. Fantastic. So take me through the transition from the UK to an exchange here in Australia. That must be every POM's dream, right, to come here?
It was pretty cool. I was pretty chuffed when I got it, I've got to be honest. And it was a bit of a, to be honest, it wasn't a gimme. It was a hard slog.
You worked for it?
Absolutely. I got the exchange. I was very fortunate. But coming to fly the Black Hawk and going to Oki to learn to fly the Black Hawk, the training standards within the Australian Army are extremely high. Mm-hmm. And so learning to fly a machine as well as you can, and it is a fairly large, complex machine, more so than the Lynx in some regards, and at the same time trying to get your head around totally different airspace procedures, that was quite challenging.
What about the Americanized version of a helicopter? Is something quite different, or did you just adapt to it?
Not really. I mean, a helicopter's a helicopter, I guess. You know, the Black Hawk is incredibly well designed, and so if anything, it's better. Ergonomically, it's generally pretty good in most regard, not in all regards, but it's generally pretty good. The checklist, the procedures are all extremely sound, developed by people far more capable than I am. So, you know, the fact that it's American and all from a different, I guess, stable of helicopters from those that I've grown up flying European helicopters, didn't make any difference.
No difference at all. Really interesting. What about your conversion? How long was your conversion course to Black Hawk?
So the conversion was, from memory, it's a while ago again, this is 2001. It was about, all in, was about 3 months.
Wow.
So it was about a month of ground school, mm-hmm. and that was really full on. So 2 weeks, 4 weeks of ground school. Then we went to Seattle for 5 weeks, because that's how the Australian Army didn't have a simulator. Mm-hmm. So we went to Seattle and flew on one of the UH-60 Alpha simulators out of one of their big army bases in near Seattle.
Gosh, and you must have had to pinch yourself. Come all the way from the UK to Australia.
I wasn't
here. I am Black Hawk training, now I'm in America.
Black Hawk, and then I'm in Seattle with a bunch of guys who I got on really well with.
Fabulous.
And we got on up to much no good. and then came back, and we sort of finished off the actual physical component of flying the aircraft, I think, with about another 3 or 4 weeks before I went up to the regiment. And then there's a very sort of long progression once you get to the regiment as well.
Become competent and whatnot. Mm. How long was it before you started to really get a hold and get ahead of the aircraft? You get the qualification, you tick all the boxes and everything, but then there's still a progression and there's a training schedule that goes
Absolutely.
With it.
Absolutely. So, you know, before I was comfortable with the aircraft, and it would have been a minimum of 12 months.
Gosh, and you're only on exchange for 2 years.
Correct. So I pretty much got to that 12-month point, and then I deployed to East Timor with the Australian Army as an aircraft captain on the Black Hawk, which, mm-hmm. if I wasn't competent at the beginning, I was certainly competent at the end. But I was competent at the beginning, because the Australian Army has quite a rigorous process for ensuring its guys progress at an appropriate rate, that it selects its aircraft captains appropriately for the right task. And so they'd gone through that whole process before we deployed.
Mm-hmm. I was lucky enough to walk off the boat in 1999 in Timor as an infantry soldier, and we were in Dili for the first half of the game, if you like.
Yeah.
And then we were picked up and taken to a place called Bobonaro.
Yes, I went there.
You would have known that
place. I wasn't based there, but I flew into it.
Mm-hmm. And it's just like a football pitch, really. Mm. It's not much more than that, and it's kind of like a police compound there. We patrolled out of there, and then we picked up there from there and went to a place called Okusi.
Yes, I know both of them.
On the other side in the enclave and whatnot. So had some fun riding around in Black Hawks. But I want to take a couple of minutes just here as we're talking about Black Hawk, because it's 40 years since Sikorsky had created that, and in 1978 this thing came to life. And in fact, in 1988, just over the road where we are, about 400 or 500 meters away from where we are, in May of 1988, Hawker de Havilland delivered its first Black Hawk to the RAF, and they ended up delivering 38 aircraft that were built here locally, and that was all finished by January of 1991. And according to Sikorsky, there's more than like 20 or 10 million flying hours that have happened with Black Hawk, and more than 2 million of those flying hours have been in combat. And some would say that it's the finest utility helicopter in the world. Now, what would you say to that particular statement?
I'd say absolutely. And I said, without a shadow of a doubt. And I think, to be honest, if that wasn't the case, then you wouldn't see the American military persevering with the Hawk in its many variants. So, you know, the Navy flies an anti-submarine, anti-surface warfare variant. It flies, the Air Force flies a search and rescue variant, and then the US Army flies, well, now flying the Lima and the Mike. Mm-hmm. Right? They wouldn't be doing that if it wasn't a bloody good machine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What's your favorite part of it?
Of the Black Hawk?
Yeah.
That's a really hard question. That's a really hard question.
The power, the speed, the utility?
It is very... It's a powerful machine. It has limitations. It has limitations. It's not the fastest. I mean, the standard cruising speed for a Black Hawk on ops is about 120 knots. It does a lot better than that.
Mm-hmm.
But if you want to sort of... if you don't want to burn too much fuel, you fly around at about 120 knots. So it's quick without being fast, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
It's an incredible platform for utility in conducting air mobile operations. So I would, you know, having flown skidded aircraft, having flown wheeled aircraft in that, you know, having flown the skidded variant of the Lynx and a wheeled aircraft with a tricycle undercarriage in a Lynx, and then going to a tail dragger helicopter, when you need to insert a large group of soldiers into a small LZ and you need, and perhaps dust is an issue or snow is an issue, it's incredibly capable. You're able to put it into an LZ very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. It's got incredible oleos, which are there for both crash attenuation, but also it allows you to literally plonk it into an LZ very, very quickly and quite firmly. Mm-hmm. It's excellent for, it's a very, very flexible all-round platform when you consider the Australian Army used it extensively in air mobile operations, not just land-based, but amphibiously as well. Mm-hmm. It's incredible, yeah.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic. Well said. Well said. It's interesting to hear the actual pilot's opinion of that, and I'm sure plenty of people would agree with you that have operated that machine. Now, in 1996, a terrible thing happened in the Australian Army, and we had our worst air disaster of all time up in Townsville, where there was 15 SAS soldiers and three Army soldiers from the 5th Aviation Regiment that were killed in an accident there that was tragic. I remember that vividly. At the time I was in the Navy, we were in operations in the Persian Gulf, and I remember hearing that news and just being completely stunned by that, and it just it was a real reminder of how dangerous military life can be, particularly military aviation and flying in close formation with helicopters. And it kind of shined a light on everything that we were doing and just kind of made us look at what we were doing with our aircraft off the back of the ship and stuff. It's no comparison, of course, but what lessons were translated to you guys as you did the conversion? That must have been something you studied during your conversion courses and when you're learning to fly Black Hawk.
Look, to be perfectly honest, I started flying Black Hawks 5 years after that incident.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, when you go through your course, they don't sit down and say, well, look, we do it this way, dude, because of that accident. That's mm-hmm. not how. So, you know, you go through your course of training and you learn to fly the aircraft the way you're told to fly it, full mm-hmm. stop. That said, the Australian Army did learn a number of very, very valuable lessons, and it applied them almost instantly. And mm-hmm. so it changed away a lot of the things about how it flew formation, how it rotated capability across the different squadrons, but it certainly learned its lesson.
It was an absolute tragedy, that's for sure, and I remember that well. And there hasn't been any accidents like that since, has there?
Touch wood.
Yeah, since those lessons have been learned.
And again, look, the Australian Army has continued to learn lessons in how it operates a Black Hawk, and so it's a constant process of change. Now, it's pretty much coming to an end, unfortunately. End of an era mm-hmm. over the next year or so as the final Black Hawks go out of service at 6th Aviation Regiment. Mm-hmm. But it's the Australian Army has adapted well to all the lessons it's been required to learn.
Mm-hmm. When did you get out of the Army?
I left the Army in 2013.
So it's pretty recent. What about all the new machines you see coming through now? What do you think of those? You can say it now, you're out.
I can. Look, you know, the MRH-90 represents a leap forward technologically, but it's not without its constraints.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm a Black Hawk diehard. I was very disappointed when the MRH-90 was selected over the UH-60 Mike.
Mm-hmm.
And to this day, I believe we should have purchased the UH-60 Mike.
Right. What's the reason?
I just think it's a more capable battlefield.
It's a better platform.
It's a better platform. And the MRH-90 is, in many ways, in some ways, it's better than the Black Hawk, but in others, the Black Hawk retains the edge. So I'm a Black Hawk guy through and through.
Yeah, and it's interesting because they bring a new type into the fleet and then everybody has to be retrained on a new type, whereas the Black Hawk is the common platform that's been there for 30 years.
And again, yeah, it is common. And, you know, the Navy have gone on to procure
Romeos.
The Seahawk. We've got Romeos. So there's a lot of commonality there. But at the same time, Navy have also procured MRH-90 with 808 Squadron. So, you know, we're operating two types. And if you think back to the A9000 project, I think the whole concept was for fleet rationalization. And, we've gone a long way to achieving that. I'll be fair. We've gone a long way to achieving that with our Defence Force.
Mm-hmm. Do you miss the military?
Not really.
Not really? You miss the flying?
Again, not really. I get to do plenty of flying in my current role.
Mm-hmm.
And it's equally challenging, but in a different way.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, you know, we don't fly around low level. We don't fly around in formation. So I don't fly off ships anymore. Those were the most incredible things that I remember about flying in the military on a variety of different aircraft. But flying in EMS, you know, the short notice, the fact that every time the bell goes, you're on operations in that aircraft mm-hmm. is incredibly rewarding. The other thing that I find incredible or really enjoyable is how we have to put all these a number of different skill sets together to accomplish a mission. It's not unusual to have to go day to night NVG to IFR to recover via an instrument approach, and it's quite, and even the military don't tend to do put all those things together. Mm-hmm. So it's challenging in that regard. Some of the weather we operate in is more challenging.
I was going to ask you about that. When everybody else is pulling the hangar doors down, you guys are pulling the doors up and wheeling the aircraft out and going in the worst of the worst conditions to go and rescue people.
To a certain extent, yes, but we apply some pretty solid risk management, and mm-hmm. If the risks are too high from a weather perspective, we just don't do it. Mm-hmm. But we have military aircraft tend not to be optimized for IFR, mm-hmm. and it's just not really a requirement. Whereas we are, so that it's not so much that we push worse weather. It's more a question of the fact, or it's more about the fact that we have an aircraft which does it better. Mm-hmm. So we have a four-axis autopilot in the aircraft that I fly now, in the AW139. We have a weather radar. We have a terrain awareness and warning system. I can literally fly this aircraft, a highly capable autopilot in the aircraft, and so I'm able to fly aircraft hands off, single pilot, in bad weather. I can couple up the aircraft, it'll climb, it'll level off, it'll intercept my nav route, it'll fly the approach, it'll do the go around, all by me managing the systems without having to fly the aircraft. And the fact that I do that single pilot is another, I guess, point of difference when compared to the military.
I was going to say the single pilot IFR thing, when I kind of was reading that, researching you for this interview, like that's like a lot of workload, but then you add the automation into it, it frees up your headspace to concentrate on what you're doing and just concentrate on actually getting ahead of the aircraft instead of hands and feet flying the aircraft when you're in those difficult conditions, right?
Absolutely. It is all about, if I was physically flying that aircraft in some of the weather that we operate in, I'd have absolutely no brain space left, right? Because I'm on my own. So,
yeah, it's hard.
Having these tools at our disposal, we also have, a moving map in the cockpit. Mm. Having all these tools at our disposal really allows me to think one step ahead, noting that, normally a normal aircraft, normally if you're going on to do an IFR NAVEX, if you like, mm-hmm. spend hours planning it. Well, we're getting off the ground in 10 minutes, mm-hmm. Longer if we need to take it, although we have a goal of getting off the ground in 10 minutes by day, if the weather's bad, we take our time and do the planning that we need to do. But still, we get off the ground remarkably quickly. And this is common for EMS operators throughout Australia. And so you do need an aircraft that allows you to start making that next set of planning decisions.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And what about the 139? Is it a fun machine to fly?
It's incredible. It's very, very different to the Black Hawk. Mm-hmm. Not so much in its design, actually. I think in many respects, it's has a number of design similarities with the Black Hawk. But it's an all-glass cockpit, third generation, I guess, if you like. Mm-hmm. All-glass, highly automated.
Fast.
It is faster. It's a significantly faster machine. So, we cruise around at 140 TAS. Black Hawk cruises around at 120 TAS. Mm-hmm. We have this incredible coupled autopilot. We have this flight management system that's got all the approaches in it. As I said, the weather radar, the terrain awareness warning system. So it's a very different machine to fly, but enjoyable nonetheless.
And what about flying around the Sydney Basin? Because in a machine like you're flying around in, this place is not really that big.
No, it's not. I mean, we go much further afield than the
Sydney
Basin. Of course,
yeah. Yeah.
It's capable. It's capable. So our neonatal aircraft here on the contract will actually regularly fly to Coffs, for instance. Well, right? It'll regularly fly out to Dubbo. Mm-hmm. So the radius of operations for our aircraft is quite significant.
Huge.
We've actually done one job to Broken Hill.
Gosh.
Right. So it was actually closer for that job to have been done from Adelaide. To give you some perspective. But again, the aircraft cruises at 140 knots. It represents a huge amount of capability for the ambulance service. From Wollongong, for instance, the aircraft would regularly be down at Merimbula, Eden, Canberra, the Canberra-based aircraft, going way out west. And on some occasions, the Canberra aircraft will actually retrieve patients to Melbourne hospitals.
Wow.
Yeah.
Amazing. I live in Cronulla.
Yeah.
And I right past the aircraft fly past in Victor 1 all
yes.
the time, and I always see the 139s flying past in Victor 1 there, and it's never lost on me how powerful that machine is and just how equipped it is to go and rescue people. And you're sending that machine to somebody in the worst of the worst situation to go and do it, and it's like every single asset the New South Wales government has available to you is the best of the best. It's the best pilots, it's the best crewies, the best paramedics, the best doctors, and you're getting there as fast as humanly possible. It's a pretty cool thing, right? It must be awesome to be part of that.
It's an incredible capability. It's a really rewarding capability to be part of. And yes, the aircraft's incredible. You mentioned the fact that it's powerful. Its single engine performance, I think, is pretty much best in class. So to give you a sense of perspective, I was water winching at 100 feet this morning on a training sortie. And although not quite at the beginning, but within about 20 minutes, had I lost an engine, and I was hovering outside ground effect. That's very different to hovering inside ground effect in terms of the amount of power required. So hovering outside ground effect is the most power-hungry profile for an aircraft, for a helicopter to fly. And so I was hovering outside ground effect, and if I had lost an engine, I could have just continued hovering there.
Would have been all right. Which, she would have been sweet.
Yeah, it would have been all right. It would have been exciting for a little bit, probably. And that's what makes the 139 stand out. Its single engine performance is incredible.
Does it have any faults? It's Italian, right?
All aircraft have their idiosyncrasies.
Yeah.
All aircraft will bite you one way or another.
And is there anything in the ergonomics of it that you're going, what do they put it there for?
Yeah, there's one thing, absolutely. So the way the aircraft's been designed is when you're operating winching in the hover, winching, for instance, or when you're operating what we call Category A, which is meeting a whole set of performance criteria, we increase the NR of the rotor from our standard 100 to 102. There's a switch on the collective.
Mm-hmm.
And what it does is effectively, if you lose an engine, it just gives you the extra 2% of droop. So normally you'd lose an engine. If you're pulling too much power, the rotor system's going to slow down. Mm-hmm. So it just gives you the extra 2% before it gets to its minimum of 90%. Gives you a little bit more time to recover from an engine failure. The problem is VNE for the aircraft with 102 set is 90 knots.
Yeah.
Right? And this aircraft climbs incredibly, incredibly fast.
Mm-hmm.
And the profiles, the Category A profiles that Leonardo helicopters like you to fly to make sure the aircraft is as safe as possible, end up with you conducting these really rapid climbs, rapid accelerations. And if you miss the NR switch, you'll go bonging straight through 90 knots and you'll US the aircraft for an inspection, and depending on the severity of the exceedance. Mm-hmm. So it's something that all 139 pilots have or will do. They will all, at one point in their careers, exceed 102% NR. And other aircraft do it automatically. I think the EC-145, for instance, automatically switches the NR. I might be wrong. I'm sure Paula will tell me, because I'm not a 145 pilot. So it does. That's one of the things that can catch you out. But by and large, that's probably one of its only flaws. It's a very, very capable machine with a few weak points.
Fantastic. In an operational role like aerial medical rescue and search and rescue and what you do here at Toll, there's a percentage of time spent in training. You guys have got some amazing facilities here, right? The Hewitt simulators, all that sort of stuff. What percentage of time do the line pilots spend in training?
Percentage of time is probably the wrong way to describe it. I think it's how frequently we train.
Right.
So depending on what operator you work for, the requirement can sometimes be for a single simulator trip a year, and then more per act. Some operators will require you to train twice a year in a simulator. We require all of our crewmen and pilots to train three times a year in the simulator. So we have three distinct training blocks per year, each one with a different focus. So I think that's got to be close to the highest training rate, you know, in terms of frequency and use of simulators and use of all our other simulation systems, whether it be our virtual reality sim, whether we're doing our CRM, whether we're using the Hewitt facility. We do it very, very frequently.
Fantastic. And tell me, what's it like working with doctors and paramedics and other people in the crew that are not pilots, that are not in the military? Is it a little bit different than what it was? It must have taken a little adjustment there to do that.
It does take a bit of adjustment, but, you know, being in the military, you're used, particularly being an aviator, you're used to working in small team environments.
Mm-hmm.
And the New South Wales Ambulance and ACT Ambulance Service doctors and paramedics are incredibly well trained, both through Toll and through their own respective services. They're incredibly well trained, and they're used to working in that with that within that small team dynamic. So in many respects, it's not that different.
Right.
They're very high performance teams. You know, the paramedics are all at the top of the game, as are the doctors. So you know, you've got all the people who you work with are highly trained, highly professional, very motivated. And when you work with a group of people like that, it's not that hard.
Are you working with the same crews on the same roster, or is it changing?
No, it rotates all the time. It rotates
But it's still a small team, right?
So you rotate. You end up flying with. It is a small team. You end up flying with different doctors and paramedics. So on one of the regional bases, for instance, there'd only be five or six paramedics and five or six doctors.
Mm-hmm.
So you get to know each other all very, very well.
Mm-hmm.
In Bankstown, where we're running three machines, the pool of paramedics and doctors is a bit larger, so it takes a little bit longer. But again, you form very, very close relationships with the ambulance staff. And I think one of the greatest compliments that was levelled at our organisation, not Toll, but as our organisation as a whole, was that people couldn't tell where Toll finished and New South Wales Ambulance started, or vice versa.
Oh, fantastic.
I think the only thing is the uniforms aren't the same.
A little bit different.
Yeah.
Fantastic. Well, mate, thank you so much for spending a little bit of time with us here on the Australian Aviation Podcast. Any parting shots before we go?
Long live the Black Hawk.
Long live the Black Hawk. Fantastic. Thanks so much, Tim. Appreciate it, mate. Cheers.
No problems. Bye.
Well, that just about wraps it up for this show. What an epic military career Tim's had. 10 years in the British Army, 10 years in the Australian Army. Everything from squirrels to lynxes and blackhawks and a couple of types in between. Mate, we really appreciate you sharing your story and taking the time with us today. So thank you very much. Now, if you haven't already got the latest edition of Australian Aviation, you can pick up your copy at your local newsagent. And if you'd rather save the trip, you can have it delivered to your letterbox each month with a subscription. Just visit our website at australianaviation.com.au to find out more about the significant savings you can make when you subscribe. And if you have a question, you can always reach out anytime on social media, or you can drop us an email at mail@australianaviation.com.au. Well, that wraps it up for this show. I'm Robert Bruss, and until next time, happy aviating, and it's bye for now.